14, 9 a.m., September 25th, 1985. Father Hugo.
Matter of Christian theology and Christian spirituality. There are some people would like to study the life of Jesus without the cross, but you can't do it. You can't do it. The whole life of Christ is oriented towards the cross. The cross is already raised in Bethlehem. To those who look for the future, the cross is already raised in Bethlehem. The speaker of those words was Dag Hammarskjöld, General Secretary of the UN a few years back. The cross is already raised in Bethlehem. We must look for the cradle on Calvary. We can't separate them. He had that insight. Many Christians and Catholics do not. He was not a Christian, but he had that insight. But what we want to examine here, we're going to talk about the cross, but we're not going to talk much about the cross of Jesus. We're going to talk rather about the cross of ourselves, how it must enter into our teaching. We cannot study the Sermon on the Mount or the Beatitudes without the study of the cross. They are an anticipation of the cross, of the Paschal Mystery, as we'll see. Now, so far, there's something else that we have not talked much about and which we must consider now, sin. We've talked in terms of those two upper levels there, the natural, and we've raised above the supernatural. That's our incarnational spirituality. We recognize sin as a possible failure, but we didn't go into it. But now we have to account for its effects, too, in our lives. It was the sin that made the cross necessary. There might have been an incarnation without a cross had the human race not sinned. In fact, it's the belief of some Catholic theologians like the Franciscan Duns Scotus that God from the beginning designed that the world should be headed by Jesus Christ, the incarnate God, even though there would be no sin. Even if you put aside the idea of sin, that God still wanted to build a world around Jesus Christ. He was the first one in the mind of God, the firstborn of every creature, St. Paul tells us. But since sin occurred, now there comes a reason for the cross, atonement. Because man had departed from that plan of God. Men through their representatives had departed from that plan of God. But God did not forget us. Like a father who sees a child that is delinquent and with compassion and goes after him, so God came after us and sent his only begotten Son to restore us. This is why our theology and our liturgy so often talks about a restoration, to restore us to the original plan of God. From the foundation of the world, he planned to raise us to that higher level, but we interrupted. We left. You see, there's that arrow pointing down there into sin, which is idolatry. And in that place, our guide there is our passion rather than reason or intelligence or faith. We're guided there by our desires and our passions. And so it's darkness rather than light. Now we have to take insurance. We haven't done that. We've been watching those two upper levels. We've been like, I remember one time I had a priest, a friend who was chaplain up at West Point, and I visited him one time. And he took me out and we watched the cadets maneuvering on the parade grounds. It was a beautiful sight. People came from far and wide to see it, standing on the hills around, to watch these wonderful, well-developed, you know, beautiful young men in their full dress uniforms marching back. They were, you know, as graceful and as beautiful as the rockets out there on the grounds as they paraded back and forth and went through their maneuvers. But to me, I felt there was something that I couldn't exactly follow. I thought, what a difference it would be if this were a battlefield. It wouldn't be so beautiful. They wouldn't be in full dress. They wouldn't be so handsome. They wouldn't be so attractive. They would be bloody and screaming with pain and crying out and killing and being killed and wounded and their bodies destroyed. The reality would be far different from this. This is really just a show. Well, that's the way. We've been so far viewing Christianity without the central thing in Christianity, the death of Jesus Christ. And now, in this second section, the Paschal Mystery, we are going to consider the effect of the cross on us, as well as in Jesus. We are not idle bystanders. We Catholics often think that way, you know. It wasn't nice for Jesus to do all that for us so I can live a nice life of ease and pleasure and have a good time and enjoy the things of the world. Wasn't that nice of Jesus to do that? All this in heaven, too. That's the way Catholics do. I remember a little girl in a school I went to one day. We were talking about the catechism, and I said, why did God make us? And she said, very naturally, I guess, the third or fourth grade, she says, God made us to enjoy ourselves in this world, to be happy with him in the next world. I think that's the philosophy of many Catholics. I think she had a large following. It was not irrelevant, the fact that her father was a millionaire brewer. She absorbed some of that philosophy, not from the catechism, but from home. But I think often we do that. But here we have to consider now the place of the Paschal Mystery in our own lives. So we will do that now. This is chapter 8, Light and Darkness. The conflict. There is a conflict in Christian life, a battle. One of the great spiritual classics is of Christian life, besides the Imitation of Christ, is the Christian combat, the spiritual combat. That's one of the classic spiritual books of Christianity, the spiritual combat. At the center of it is a combat. And that's what we have to realize. We are being unrealistic, like watching the handsome cadets in their maneuvers, if we don't realize this combat. There's going to be some casualties. There's going to be some suffering. It's not going to be all a dress rehearsal in living Christianity. So we have to consider that. Some people reject the idea of a conflict, but it's there. We'll see it now. We're going to talk about the relationship of nature and grace, the supernatural order and the natural order. That's where the conflict is. That's where the conflict develops. Now, some people will reject the idea of a conflict. They'll say that grace presupposes nature, grace is built on nature, and there's no conflict. But we'll see that there is a conflict, and we have to reckon with that conflict. The fact that Jesus died should indicate that there's a conflict. That's the proof of the conflict. And here I have at the top of the page there are two statements from the Vatican Council to indicate that this is still modern Christianity. This may be traditional, but it's still the doctrine of the Vatican Council. Therefore, man is split within himself, say the fathers of the Vatican Council. As a result, all of human life, whether individual, you and I personally, or collective in our society, shows itself to be a dramatic struggle between light and darkness. That is still the doctrine of the Church, and that's beautifully phrased. A dramatic struggle between light and darkness. And then another statement, which I've put together, for a monumental struggle against the powers of darkness pervades the whole history of the human race. The whole history. Nothing has changed in Christianity about that. That is there. And we are part of that dramatic struggle. And we must learn how, what we are to do in that dramatic struggle. Now you'll notice they say it's collective and individual. Cardinal Newman, in one of his sermons, puts it this way, that the best that can be said of any of us is there is a light side and a dark side in each of us. Whenever we think, you know, whenever we think there's a dramatic struggle between dark and light, as we look out in the cosmos, it's a great cosmic thing, but Newman brings it right to us. Personally, that struggle between light and darkness is in us all. The best that can be said of any of us is that there is a light side and a dark side in each of us. And so the struggle goes on. And we must see how it is. Now the conflict, as I say, is involved in this problem. One of the oldest problems in Catholic and Christian theology is the relationship of nature and grace. Now we've already dipped into it. That conflict between darkness and light we've already noticed in the Gospel of St. John. We might say that this conflict between light and darkness, he uses this figure, as I pointed out, that's his way of talking about the two ways, light and darkness. We live by faith, we're in the light. We don't live by faith, we're in darkness, according to St. John. And already condemned. St. John carries it to its limits. So the whole Gospel there tells us about this conflict between light and darkness. St. Paul, we said, calls it a conflict between flesh and spirit. And we mortify the flesh. We have to kill the flesh. Mortify it. He who kills the flesh, who by the Spirit mortifies the deeds of the flesh, will have light, life. So we've really been in this, speaking of it, but we haven't entered into it. It's in the beginning because it's simply Christianity. We can't get into Christianity without getting into this conflict. And the conflict then is between nature and grace. The conflict is caused not simply by man's sin, but because we have been raised to the state of grace and our nature, our natural desires pull us away from God. Our natural desires cause us to resist God. God wants to take possession. He wants to invade us, to use a common term. He wants to take possession of our inner citadel, our mind and our heart. And we reject that. And this is really the original sin. The rejection of God, or resistance to God, is, I think, the way that Dietrich Bonhoeffer defined original sin. Resistance to God. It's a beautiful definition, although he's not a Catholic. It's resistance to God. It's sort of built into us because our nature seeks its own perfection in its own way. Naturally, God created it that way as an autonomous unit. And so it tends to be that way. And so there is this conflict between nature and grace. However, we have to understand that correctly and in the manner the church teaches. And in order to understand that, I have to talk to you about the double relationship between nature and grace. This is the oldest problem in theology. As I say, St. John and St. Paul talk about it. St. Augustine has a book called On Nature and Grace. Karl Rahner, who just died, had a book on nature and grace. And I suppose there have been 10,000 books on the relationship of nature and grace down through these centuries. The relationship between nature and grace is the central problem of Christianity and living a Christian life. So, if you've never heard about it, now would be a good chance to get acquainted with it. the pull is provided and the possibility of conflict because of the fact that God gives us this grace to live a kind of life which is no longer a merely natural life. Nevertheless, we find now, and this is the settled teaching of the church, that there is a double relationship between nature and grace, and the one is a relationship of harmony, and thus we speak of the harmony between nature and grace, and the other is a relationship of conflict between nature and grace, and this is what we tend to deny and which few Catholics acknowledge and some really do deny, that there is a conflict between nature and grace. The argument is, how can there be a conflict between nature and grace when God created nature and God is the author of grace? That's a good argument, but it's not valid. There's an opening there for a conflict, and that's why we have the cross, and that's why that appears in our lives too. Now, in studying this relationship of nature and grace, we will start with the harmony so that we'll be sure that all our bases, our foundational points are correctly laid. And we find in it that there is a threefold harmony between nature and grace. In three ways we can say and discover a relationship between nature and grace. The first way is this way. They're marked here, I think. Yeah. They're in they're just noted here, but you can go back to reference to them. The first way is in the substance of nature. Nature in itself is good. Nature is God's creation. It's His gift to us. It is substantially good. So we don't find a conflict between the substance of nature and grace. There is an area of harmony. There. Nevertheless, there's a difference between nature and grace, and in a certain sense, we even have to be mortified, even the substance of our nature. St. Paul is the one that introduced that word so early into the discussion, to mortify or to kill. And he's not just talking about killing in general, he's talking about the death of Christ. St. Paul sees the whole of Christianity through the passion and the death and the resurrection of the Lord as through a prism. Like you'd look at something through a colored glass. Let's suppose you have a green glass in one eye and a pink glass in the other. St. Paul is looking through a prism. The death and the resurrection of the Lord. He's looking backwards. He wasn't with the apostles before the passion. He only joined them after the resurrection. He's looking back at Christ through the passion and the resurrection. So he sees the passion and the resurrection as dominating the whole life of Christ. And that's why he can say, he who lives according to the Spirit will make dead, will mortify the deeds of the flesh in order to live. We live after the passion and death too, and we have to look through it through the same prism which St. Paul used, through the prism of the death and the resurrection of the Lord. And that's what we mean by the Paschal mystery, the death and resurrection of the Lord. That Paschal mystery has been set right in the middle of our sights by the Second Vatican Council as the very center of the Christian life. Now, then, in the substance, there is no conflict between nature and grace. We don't have to commit suicide to live a supernatural life. We don't have to eat ground glass. We don't even have to do the heroic and frightful things that we've seen these contemporaries of ours doing in this book that we've been reading, who deliberately elect to join the most deliberately, the most destitute and lowly of the world's poor and suffering. Like a Maximilian Kolbe or this sister Mariah, Mother Mariah, and many others. Isn't it heartening to realize that despite all the talk about the softness of modern Christians, that we do have people like that that rise to the heights of unbelievable heroism under unbelievable barbarism. And yet God's grace is able to sustain them and carry them through this. I guess we all would, we listen to these things, we feel, my heavens, what would I do in circumstances like that with my weak flesh? And the only answer is that God is the one who does it in them, and he gives us the grace relative to our need. And they do it not because of their own strength. It's not because they're supermen or superwomen. It's because of the grace of God. I can do all things in him who strengthens me, St. Paul explained. And so this is the marvelous things. This is what we say in the preface for martyrs. I guess I should have read that preface this morning, that he through his weakness, he accomplishes these magnificent works. Through our weakness, he accomplishes these magnificent deeds in ordinary human beings. But, you see, this is an extreme situation which they've deliberately elected, this marvelously, to identify themselves with the poorest and the worst. And we're not called upon, basically, to do that, although we are called upon when Jesus said, love one another as I have loved you. It's all written in the gospel. But the substance of our nature is good, and we don't have to destroy it. We're asked to die, to fast occasionally, but not to eat ground glass. We don't even have to eat ashes like St. Francis of Assisi did once in a while. We don't recommend that dietetically, even by the gospel. But these are extremes of love which the saints will sometimes point the way to for us. We preserve our nature. We want to use our nature to serve God. But in a sense, we still must mortify the substance of our nature. And we can explain that with an illustration. Whenever an artisan wishes to make something out of steel or iron, he wants to make some object, a fence or a door or a window or a sword, or maybe a piece of jewelry of steel. How does he do it? Steel is hard and unyielding. He heats it. He liquefies the steel. And then, in its liquid state, he can mold it into any shape he wants. Now, that's what mortification of nature means for us. Our nature is good, substantially good, but it is like steel. It's resistant to God. And it needs to be softened and made malleable. And it is done by the cross, by suffering, by mortification. Our nature becomes docile and flexible and responsive to the grace of God. I'm sure you've all learned this, that through trial you have learned much in the Christian life. We're mellowed. We are made more flexible, more responsive to the impulses of divine grace. And this is what God wants. He puts us in the fire. That's an image that the Scripture uses already in the Old Testament, and Saint Peter takes it up. I often read it here with the death on the funerals of our older sisters to explain their long lives. That as the gold is refined by fire, so the divine goldsmith refines our lives by continuous suffering. And that's how we can see often these long and painful human lives as a refinement. They have no other positive purpose. But whenever you see them at the end of life so beautiful in their patience and their love and their concern. We had a sister that died here not long ago. Her death was truly beautiful. A long ordeal of cancer and suffering. When she died, like you would expect, would hope, that a Catholic religious would die. And I've seen others that their death was less, even religious, was less edifying. They did not receive the refinement God intended. They resisted. We have always that choice. That's the innermost part of our freedom. We can form our own attitudes. And so whether we refined or not depends pretty much on us, our own attitude, our own acceptance or non-acceptance, our own attitude of faith and love in these daily trials, these daily refinements. We don't have to wait for old age to get them. They're happening all through our lives, although they intensify as we get older. So in this sense, even the substance of nature has to be mortified, so it can be molded and formed and be responsive to the grace of God. You can see, say, when a Father Maximilian Kolb would give half his food to a neighbor, how responsive he had made his nature. He was as hungry as anybody else. But he had trained and refined himself to the point that he could hand away the ounce of food, or Mother Maria could give to another the ounce of food that she had, even though she herself was starving and in need. So this is mortification of the deepest kind, you see, right in the very substance of nature. So on the one hand, we affirm doctrinally that there is no conflict between nature and grace, because God is the author of nature, or the creator of nature, as he is the author of grace. But nevertheless, because of our supernatural destiny, because of the refinement we must go through to become holy, then we must even mortify the substance of nature, not to destroy it, not to eat the ground glass, but to leave it be made pliable and flexible in the hands of God. That's the first way in which there is harmony between nature and grace. So that makes us orthodox, you see. We're not claiming that there's anything wrong with nature. Nature's right. It is a creation of God. Now, the second way in which there is harmony is in our natural activity. Now, natural activity is all the things that we can do in the order of nature, like I can walk and talk, I can sleep, I can work, I can read, I can think, or any things that we do with our natural gifts. And they are a natural activity. So they're good too. And we don't, when St. Paul speaks of mortifying the natural, he doesn't mean we should damage our natural activity. Now, I think that this is very important, because in this retreat too, I have been misunderstood by some people, and they take it to mean that, although I always explain it as carefully as I can. It doesn't mean we destroy our natural activity. We don't have to destroy our sight or our hearing or cripple ourselves, or even to accept crippling unless it's necessary. If something happens to us, we should fight it and preserve our natural health as far as we're humanly able to do so that we can serve God better with our natural activity. So we are not to do anything that would injure ourselves. This is the way, perhaps, that some of the saints have done what was wrong, like a Saint Francis. He fasted too much. He injured his health. We would have had him longer. He would have produced more. He recognized this himself. He was over-enthusiastic about fasting. Of course, we're not, as a rule. Sometimes we shun fasting, as though you'd think that Catholics were dying like flies as a result of fasting. But I think there have been very few in the history of the Church. So we don't need to fear it too much. St. Bernard injured his health, and he regretted it at the end of his life. St. Clare is a wonderful example of injuring her health. She was so devoted to the cross of Christ that she imposed impossible penances on herself, and she spent most of her life as an invalid or a semi-invalid. Of course, they didn't have medical science in those days. They didn't know these things. A lot of it was in ignorance. We have a lot of knowledge that they didn't have. Even a little flower who died when she was 24, you know, her death would be considered unnecessary. She had tuberculosis, but they had no control over it all. They simply called it by the dreadful name of consumption, because that's exactly what it did. It just consumed a person. And yet that was, you know, at the turn of this century. So there's just a difference in the circumstance, which also explains something about their spirituality. But, you see, our natural activity is good. But nevertheless, In a real sense, we must mortify our natural activity, and we spent several days studying how. We denaturalize it, in a sense, by removing the natural motive and the natural attachments. That's where we do the mortification. That area of freedom, which is at the root of our actions, that's where we mortify ourselves. And now I will eat and drink, as St. Paul says, for the glory of God, and everything else I do, I will do for the glory of God. I simply shut out the motive of pleasing myself, or eating and drinking, or doing these other things for my sheer enjoyment. That is mortification. You see, but that mortification is in the area of my freedom, in the area of my desires, in the area of my motivation. And so we mortify our natural activity by raising our natural actions to the supernatural level. And automatically, therefore, renouncing a mere natural motivation. That's the way we can mortify our natural action. Another good example, one we've already seen, is the example, the image of the grafting of a tree. I take a branch from an apple tree and I graft it into a peach tree. St. Francis de Sales uses this example. I take a branch of an apple tree and I graft it into a peach tree. You take maybe a dozen branches of that from an apple tree, and I graft them into a peach tree. Now, what happens? The peach tree will continue to produce life and continue to produce peaches, except on those 12 apple branch trees, it will produce apples. The fruit is determined by the branch, but the vitality comes from the trunk. Now, we are grafted into Christ. And our fruit is to be determined by the trunk, by the vine. But the fruit is determined by us. There'll be human fruits. We will laugh and talk and eat and drink and write and speak and do all the actions of other people, other human beings, like pagans. Outwardly, we look like just like a pagan. The difference between the Christian is in that inward flow of sap upwards from Jesus Christ, vitalizing our activity, if it does, and then they become supernatural. The apple tree now is producing peaches. Super peaches. You see? Now this is the way we mortify our natural activity, by mortifying it inwardly in the area of our freedom. But the natural activity externally and substantially is good. We will become better workers, more skilled craftsmen, because now we work under a dedication to God and to our neighbor and to the church. It should enhance our capacity. It should improve our output. We cannot offer anything second rate to God. He wants the first fruits, and so we must give Him the best. So instead of giving up our natural activity, you see our activity is supernaturalized. Now that's the way we renounce our natural activity. We mortify it. Well, now I think we'll stop and we'll continue and complete this subject the next time we have those two points finished. We'll die now, pray, if you please, and then we'll meet again at 10:45.